that as a whole do not know much about Vendabhadrajan Brahm. And I thought his early times of life is quite interesting. One day, by the way, before he became a monk, he was called Peter Vicks. And this young Peter one day went with his brother, the grandfather took both of them to the Houston railway station. He was so fascinated with the steam engine, he wanted to become an engineer. Then later on he wanted to become the first astronaut of the British astronaut. The best out of all that is, he wanted to one day to have long hair, their fancy suit, and to scream in front of the mic. And that is the best out of all. Can you imagine Bhajan Ram as the famous rock star? That is what he wanted to become.
I've got a fancy suit.
It's fascinating what you want to be when you are a young man. And some of those things you want to be are just the conditioning, the people who you see get respect and adulation. And as a young man, you try and want to be the same. However, when you're very young, you're not really sure what you want to aspire towards. And so much of your youth is always a search for what is really useful and meaningful in life. And later on, especially when you go to university, especially like a good university where you've got many, many options in front of you. When I looked and see what I wanted to do in my life, I always thought that there were two things, two criteria I wanted to satisfy. And this was an important part of deciding where I wanted to go in my life. And those two criteria were whatever career or life I would live had to be for other people's happiness and benefit, so that I could create a better world in a small way or a big way. Other people's happiness was important to me. And the other half of this criterion for life was my own happiness. So I wanted to find some sort of career which would give me personal fulfillment, but also be of service to others. My first experiment in that was being a school teacher. Even though I could have done much more than just being an ordinary school teacher, I thought that that was a way that you could take young people and mould them into adults, good adults. And it also did give me a lot of personal happiness being a school teacher. I enjoyed working with children. But there was something else which was always behind in my mind, and that was actually becoming a bhikkhu, becoming a monk. And it was very important or very helpful that in the Thai tradition that you could become a monk for a short period of time. So you could test it out whether you like being a monk or not. And I thought that was very helpful, because one of the problems when like monks or nuns aren't permitted to leave the Sangha, or that they are heavily discouraged from doing so, is that sometimes we have old monks and nuns who made a decision to go forth when they were young, and now they regret that decision. So they're not happy being monks, they're not happy being nuns. And it's much more important to have a person who is a monk or a nun who wants to be there, rather than someone who's trapped in a lifestyle because there's no way to leave. So that was very comforting for me, that in the Thai tradition, you could become a monk, you could try it out. And if for some reason or another it didn't work for you, you could always leave. And there was no humiliation, there was no sense of failure. It was always considered to be what a wonderful thing you've done, and what amazing good karma you've made, just being a monk for a short time. So that actually helped me be a monk, that I could know I could always leave if I wanted to. And indeed I did tell my family and friends that I was just going to become a monk for 1 or 2 years. You know, become enlightened, get that out of the way, then come get married. I never knew what enlightenment was. But a young man is like that, to do these things and get them out of the way. But as soon as I became a monk, it was a strange experience that I knew that was the only thing I ever wanted to do. Some people are fortunate in that regard, that they find their career or their place in life, and they know whether it's a doctor or whether it's an accountant or whether it's an engine driver. They know that that's the place where they belong, and they are so happy and peaceful in their occupation. And that for me happened when I was a monk. And even though after about one week as a monk, I realized I was going to be in this forever. That I'd used to tell people when they asked me, "Are you going to this forever?" I said, "No." I said, "Ah, yes, you are." I said, "No, I'm not." I said, "Yes, you are. How would you go? You've only been a monk for a week." And I never see those people again. I could resist by saying, "I told you so." But it's wonderful to have that experience where you know that this is where you belong, a sense of personal happiness and also the ability to help others. It does give you a huge source of inner energy. I know that sort of later on Buddhism was supposed to split into the Mahayana and the Theravada tradition. And one was supposed to be out there trying to help others and sacrificing oneself. And the Theravada was supposed to be just concerned about one's own enlightenment and not helping anyone at all. And I love going to conferences where there are representatives of the different strands of Buddhism. And just to stand up there and say, "You know, I'm the Hinayana monk, I'm just here for my own enlightenment, and look how hard I work for all of you." To make it very clear that there is no real difference between those two great traditions. You know, when you see just how hard Theravada monks can work. Now, monks like myself would travel all over the world teaching the Dhamma. And you can see that there is a difference. A good monk, no matter what tradition, will always spend time, part of their time, developing their own sila, samadhi, and panya. And they'll always spend part of the time spreading that teaching to others. And you all know that that was part of the original Buddhist teachings. To spend time in solitude, to develop your meditation and wisdom, because without your own experience, as the Buddha once said, if you try and help someone else, you're like the person stuck in the mud, trying to pull someone else out who's stuck in the mud. Now you both are in trouble. First of all, you have to get out onto the bank, out onto the dike in the paddy fields, and then you can pull the other person out. So you do need your own personal experience and wisdom and virtue before you can help other people. So which is why that in the Theravada tradition we do spend those early years of monastic life having very few duties and not helping other people at all. That's why in my monastery in Australia there are many young monks there, and I will not send them overseas. I will not send them to other viharas. I will not allow them to do teachings. Because I need to protect them by protecting a young plant, to make sure they're strong and they're mature before they go out to help others. And when one understands that this is a path, we have to develop our own insights, our own virtue, our own peace first, and then we spend the time helping other people. And we realize that this path, the original Buddhism, is by far the best. You don't need to put off your enlightenment in order to help all other beings. In fact, if you do put off your enlightenment and start helping other beings, you're like the blind leading the blind. You don't know where you're taking other people, and they don't know where you're taking them to. And that's a great danger in our world. So it's important to be able to become enlightened first before one goes helping others. We never think that the Buddhism will ever die out, because an enlightened person, they may teach hundreds, maybe thousands of people, and out of those hundreds of thousands, maybe one or two may see the Dhamma and understand themselves and become arahats. So that's all one needs to keep the Aryan tradition going, the tradition of the noble ones. As long as they are arahats in this world, says the Buddha, then the Dhamma will always be strong. And as long as people are practicing that Eightfold Path, then the path towards all the attainments is open to you. So you don't need to put off your practice until the time Maitreya Buddha comes. That is a silly thing to do. It's like a person who has cancer say, well, I'm not going to go see the doctor today. I'm going to wait till they make the big breakthrough and then I'll go see the doctor. We already have the big breakthrough now. It's the Eightfold Path and it's there for you. So we should never put off the opportunity for practicing the Dhamma. The path is a very beautiful path, a very effective path, and it works. And maybe you can see in your own life, in your own practice, just how a little bit of virtue, a little bit of peace, a little bit of wisdom creates enormous happiness and freedom in life. And it's that which drives you forward on the path to emancipation. I often tell people that the main driving force of Buddhism is not so much the pursuit of wisdom as the pursuit of happiness. Because people pursue wisdom in the universities or in the debating clubs or in the philosophy of life. And sometimes those philosophers, sometimes I listen to what they say and just realize just how little they've understood. Mostly because they haven't had sufficient experience. Their data with which they work on is very limited to the realm of the five senses and they have very little understanding of the mind. And because of that, that whatever conclusions they have about life is only based on partial evidence. And so that I understood as a scientist, if you wish to find out about the nature of things, you have to have a thorough investigation, which also includes investigation of the mind. And this is where we meditate, to find out what's inside, what is the mind and how it works. But more than that, what drives a person forward on the path, I always say, is the pursuit of happiness. The pursuit of real happiness. Because you'll find whatever you do in your life, it is happiness or the pursuit of happiness which drives it. Whether you're watching the cricket or whether you're pursuing wealth or looking after your family, or even pursuing the path of meditation, the wisdom, you're doing this for the ending of suffering, in other words, for happiness. And many of you who have heard my talks on the internet or here in Sri Lanka or over in places like Singapore or Australia, you know that many years ago when I decided to change the order of the Four Noble Truths, because I found that in many books on Buddhism in the West, especially written by non-Buddhists, they'd always begin by saying Buddhism is pessimistic. And the reason they said that was because it started with the first noble truth of suffering and they never read any further. As you all know in psychology, first impressions are important. And the first impression is usually the impression which sticks. So if you're going for an interview for a job, you have to make sure you're well-groomed because that first impression is what your potential employer will remember. So I decided to change the first impressions, try rearranging the Four Noble Truths, and starting with Noble Truth number 3. Noble Truth number 3 is the end of suffering, Nibbana, or as the Buddha often would say, Paramang Sukham, the ultimate happiness. So when people in the West would ask me to explain Buddhism, I said the Four Noble Truths, ultimate happiness. And that first impression got people very interested. Yeah, we want to be happy. Ultimate happiness. Yeah, we'll go for that. And then, how do you get ultimately happy? That's Noble Truth number 4. Or I believe number 2. Yeah, we want to know how. We know sometimes it doesn't work. Yeah, that's Noble Truth number 3 in my stream, the Buddha's Noble Truth number 1. The suffering happens. But why? Yeah, there we go, that's Noble Truth number 4 in my speed. Noble Truth number 2 of the Buddha. So the Four Noble Truths becomes happiness, its cause. Sometimes it doesn't work, and why doesn't it work? The Four Noble Truths, rearranged for marketing to our modern world. And it's very potent when you start teaching like that. Because it's not changing the Buddha's teachings. It's just reordering them, that's all. And by reordering them, you're emphasizing a very, very important part about the path of happiness. And when I start like that, it's very easy to continue by saying, look, if you keep five precepts, it actually makes you happier. And straight away that really intrigues people. Because so often, even in places like Sri Lanka, we think, yeah, five precepts is some sort of penance you have to do on holidays to get it out of the way quickly so you can go back to your whiskey on the day after. It's, you know, it's something which is tough to do. And this is the idea we're trying to abolish, to understand that keeping the precepts makes you happier. That's why I said, what did I say this? About, I think it could have been in the car somewhere, where I was saying as a young man when I gave up drinking alcohol at parties, I enjoyed myself even more. And, you know, to be quite explicit, it was in the later part of the parties when you find a nice girl and you start, you know, kissing and goodness knows what else. If I was drinking, you didn't remember much of that, and that was the best part of the party. And so when I didn't drink alcohol, I was much more alert and aware, and I enjoyed myself much more. I was there for the best part. But all my friends, by the time they got to the girl, they were all just half drunk, so they didn't know what they were doing, so they missed out. What I was saying there was that the five precepts actually make you happier. And that's why people should understand this and start keeping them. The Buddha never meant to harm or hurt people or give people a bad time. He wanted to increase people's happiness and well-being. That was even more the case with meditation. So people who think that meditation is a difficult thing to do and you have to go through so much suffering and pain are missing the point. If you're meditating in the correct way, it should make you more peaceful, more happy. It should increase your happiness, not decrease it. As your body and mind become lighter and more full of ease. So when you follow the path of inner happiness, you are following the path of deep, deep meditation. And it was very wonderful for me actually to start reading the suttas for myself, learning Pali and reading them for myself. And I encourage each one of you to, you know, read those suttas for yourself. Don't just depend upon the monks, because sometimes the monks get it badly wrong. As somebody said last night on Dependent Origination, Paticca Samuppada. Now I thought it was only one life, because a couple of monks said that. I thought, oh, that makes sense. Until I read the suttas for myself and said, no, you cannot say that. It's untenable. It's very, very, very clear with all the definitions which the Buddha made that dependent origination was supposed to show the passage between one life and the next and how it works, the physics of it. And it was great to be able to see that for myself. If you don't believe me, go and see. I was the same with the debate that should have been over a long time ago between Vipassana and Samatha. And that's a very silly debate, because you just look at the books yourself and it's very, very clear there is no difference between Samatha and Vipassana. There's only the Eightfold Path. That's the way we practice. There's no two paths. It's just one path of developing deep and deep meditation. In fact, you can actually describe the path of meditation as a path, no matter what it takes, no matter how it's done, of suppressing the five hindrances and letting go of the five senses. That's what meditation is supposed to be doing. Suppressing the five hindrances, those concerns of the five senses, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and doubt. Because it's the five hindrances which stop you gaining wisdom. And those five hindrances have disappeared. Your mind is clear enough and strong enough to see the truth. So the whole purpose of this little retreat is not to gain jhanas. Jhanas is the vehicle for overcoming the five hindrances. The main purpose should be suppress the hindrances. Because when those hindrances are suppressed, the mind is empowered, can see things deeply, can hold them long enough to really see their true nature. So you're not seeing what you want to see, nor are you denying what you don't like seeing, but the mind has the courage and the strength to see the truth, no matter what. When the ego and self get involved, Because of pride, we only want to see what is convenient for us to see. Which is why you have people like Christians and Muslims and Hindus believing the most ridiculous thing. And sometimes I was quite fascinated. How can anyone in our modern age believe that? What is the psychological process for such a belief? And it's very, very clear when those hindrances are there, we actually bend the truth to suit ourselves. Any evidence which is quite clear, we either black out from our mind, we just cannot see it. And other evidence, we twist and bend to suit us. So when a Christian goes and visits, say, the Grand Canyon, they say, isn't it wonderful that God carved this out 7,000 years ago to make it look like it was an erosion over many, many millions of years? They bend the truth to fit themselves. And these can be intelligent people who believe such nonsense. But there's also intelligent people here in Sri Lanka who believe soap barber will solve all of your ills. And sometimes I say that and say, actually, I'm probably going too far. But it's amazing just how we will bend the truth to fit ourselves. And that's the work of the five hindrances. They are marvelous deceivers. And sometimes that people, I tell people that unless those five hindrances are completely abandoned, you can't even trust what you see, or what you hear, or what you feel, or what you know. All of that has been bent, changed. You cannot trust it. Only when the five hindrances have been abandoned, only then can you trust the data of your senses and what your mind sees. So in order to gain that wisdom, you have to overcome those five hindrances. Unfortunately, the five hindrances, as they are overcome more and more, give one also more happiness. So again, happiness seems to be the motivating force, much more so than wisdom, to search for inner peace and happiness. Which is why that when I started looking at the path of meditation, the arousing of happiness became such an important part, the arousing of piti sukha, and not being afraid of that piti sukha, and developing that all the way into jhanas. And I read such things as the story of the Buddha's own enlightenment in the Mahasatika Sutta, number 36 of the Majjhima Nikaya, where after so many years of asceticism, the Buddha thought of the time he sat under the rose apple tree and entered the first jhana. And the important point here was that Buddha thought, why am I afraid of that happiness and bliss which has nothing to do with unwholesome things? For years, the Buddha thought that such blissful states could not be the path to enlightenment. But the realization, fortunately for all of us, came, yes, that is the path to enlightenment. I should not be afraid of that bliss. And so the Buddha started pursuing this path of inner bliss called the jhanas, which led him to enlightenment. So it is important that we also pursue that path of inner happiness. As you sit down and you let go of the past and the future, you let go of thinking, already you get a sense of inner peace. And to recognize that inner peace is a source of happiness. When a burden has been taken away from you, the worries about your future and your past, and all the thoughts about your family and business or whatever else is taken away, it gives you an immense sense of freedom. And then you go deeper by going into your breathing. And all the other burdens of the five senses, the itches and aches and pains in your body, the sights, sounds, smells and tastes which you have to deal with, are all taken away. You are liberated from them enough, like it's taken a big heavy burden away from you, so you feel free again. And as the breath starts to disappear, because the last part of the five senses disappears, it's a state of freedom and happiness. As you get deeper and deeper in your meditation, the happiness should go stronger and stronger. And you can test your meditation by seeing how much happiness is growing. If it's growing stronger and stronger, deeper and deeper, then you know you're on the path. As the Buddha once said, this is in the Jatakas, the more you let go of the five senses in the body, the more happiness and bliss you feel. If you want to experience complete bliss, then completely let go of the five senses. Now, what the Buddha was saying, complete bliss, was an approximation. It's not complete bliss, but it's close enough. Because one lets go of the five senses, one enters and gets close to the realm of the jhanas, which are blissful states. When someone asked me the other day, I forget who it was, can you suggest one sutra which I can read? And I said, why not the Aranavibhanga Sutra? And one of the reasons I said that was because it also includes the saying of the Buddha, monks, you should know how to distinguish between pleasures. There are some pleasures you should avoid, and those are the pleasures of the five senses. There are some pleasures you should follow and develop, which is the pleasures of the mind, the jhanas. He specifically told you to develop those. And I mention this because even today some people think that you get attached to such pleasures. You should not develop them, you should fear them. When you get too blissed out in meditation, people say, oh, you're going to get attached. And some even teachers say that. That is not just wrong, that is dangerously wrong, because that is preventing people from realizing the fruits of the path. And such ideas should be vigorously argued against. This path of Buddhism is a path of peace. One of my favorite sayings is the path of Dhamma is a path without groaning. If you're groaning and complaining, oh, it's so hard, you're missing the path. This is a Buddhist saying. The Eightfold Path is a path without any groaning. It's not a tough path. If it is a tough path, you're missing it. It's an easy path, a gentle path, the middle path of ever-increasing happiness. So as you meditate, your happiness should be increasing. If it's going the opposite direction, take that as a sign you're doing something wrong. So number one, you don't need to sit in full lotus on broken glass in order to become enlightened. This is not just some ascetic, austere, matter of practice only for tough guys, like US Marines. This is a path for the gentle people. So you sit comfortably, and you gently develop the mind in happiness. You find that happiness is the glue which sticks your mind on the object. If you're enjoying the breath, it's so easy to watch. If you're not enjoying it, you have to use willpower. And that makes you even more stressed out. So when you're watching your breath, make it fun. Enjoy the breath. If necessary, you can breathe in a deliberately sensual breath. Oh, that was so nice. And breathe out. Oh, yeah. You could do that. One of the great meditating teachers in Thailand, still alive, that's the only thing he ever teaches. When you ask him, can you teach me meditation? He says, breathe in just nicely. And breathe out, that's really good. And that's all he teaches. And he's a great master. So when you do breathing, bring it happiness in. For those of you who get dull when you're meditating, a very simple trick is to take your awareness away from your breathing for a second or two. Put it on your face and make a smile. And as soon as you made the smile, go back to your breath. You'll find it has more happiness. Even when I was a student in Cambridge, just because I got tricked into it, I got into the rowing club. And when I got, what they did was they had a big meeting, they had served you free sherry. So that time I went along for the free sherry. Before I knew it, I signed up. It was good exercise, but I was never really into sport for winning. I just wanted to have some fun. But one day we had this very long race, and I was the bow, in the back of the boat. And you know, when you do rowing in an eight, the coach is on the bank shouting at you with the megaphone. And he started shouting at me and saying, he said my lame name, Betts, you're making a horrible face, a horrible expression, smile. And it was something which I learned, and everybody knows this in coaching. Instead of grimacing, because I was pulling the oar in such a long race and I was putting full effort into it, and it was hurting, physically. And when I smiled, it was much easier to pull the oar. It's basic psychology. Whatever you're doing in life, you know, even if you're a woman giving birth to a baby, if you groan and grimace, it hurts much more. If you smile, it hurts less. So a little bit of smiling gave you more energy, even when you were rowing. And a little bit of smile when you meditate just starts to trigger inner happiness. And you're breathing in, not just having to work hard, but it starts to become fun. And I always say this is the pivot point of meditation. When a person is meditating and they start to get joy with the breath, when the pity sukha starts to arise. Because once that pity sukha starts to arise and you're breathing in a beautiful, delightful breath, then you don't need to motivate yourself anymore. You carry on meditating because it's so much fun, it's joyful to do. And then people, especially young people, will meditate not because their parents tell them to, but because they like to. It's fun to do. And as that fun starts to get more and more intense, the breath starts to get more and more peaceful. You don't have to force yourself to watch it. It's natural. You like watching it. It's interesting. And because you like to do it, you don't need effort anymore. And this chaitanya, this world which disturbs the whole process of stillness, is subdued until it disappears. Because you enjoy, you don't need to strive. Because you're not striving, you get more still. Because you get more still, the breath becomes even more subtle. Because of stillness and subtlety, the happiness keeps increasing. It's what we call the snowball effect. The happiness gets stronger and stronger and stronger. The mind gets more and more energized. Once the mind has enough energy, that's when we see these beautiful limitless. To understand another way of looking at this, we have your five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching. We have the sixth sense of the mind. You give most of your energy to the five senses, so they take the lion's share of any energy. When you do a retreat such as this, your five senses are being subdued. Everyone is wearing ordinary clothes, usually white or at least subdued clothes. There's no Hawaiian t-shirts. The women don't wear scents. There's no sort of things which excite people. So the five senses are being calmed down, calmed down. At the same time, the mind is getting energy and power. And there comes the time when the mind's energy is stronger than the five senses' energy. And that's when the mind manifests. In your deep meditation, the five senses disappear, and what you're left with is the sixth sense of mind. Usually appears as a light to the nirmita. But sometimes, and some of you have already mentioned this, it's a very common, when you really start to empower that mind, that nirmita, that light, is there even when you open your eyes. Even when you're having your dinner, you see your lunch and there's a big light in front of you which you're looking through. All that is the mind has become so strong, so powerful, that even with your eyes open, it still overwhelms the five senses. It's the strongest of the senses, and so even with your eyes open, it's there. This is just a sign your mind is becoming strong and empowered and dominant. But as I mentioned, I think in the first talk, it's not just the energy, the power, but it's the bliss of that mind. By these stages, you're becoming a very, very happy meditator. And again, I mention this as a teacher. I look much more at a person's happiness and a sense of ease than I do about what they tell me in their meditation. People come along and say they saw this wonderful nimitta. They're not smiling when they tell me. I realize maybe it's imagination. Because the real nimitta has come along. My goodness, how powerful. So beautiful. And that's when I use such expressions as a bliss better than sexual orgasm. Because that's what these nimittas really do for you. Just a huge amount of power and energy and bliss. Which is why that sometimes when those nimittas come up, they're hard for people to control. They're a bit too powerful for you. And there have been several times when I've got the nimittas coming up, this is before jhanas, where I think you cannot handle any more bliss. It's just more intense than any human being can take. But one thing I discovered, there is no limit to the amount of bliss you can experience. And I tell people this and say, you know, that monks, nuns, we're not people who abandon pleasure. In fact, we're hedonists. We pursue pleasure, only the ultimate pleasure, the pleasure of liberation, nirvana. So we're pleasure seekers, the bhikkhus, the meditators. Only we know a pleasure which most other people never access. And it's a pleasure which leads to full liberation, to nirvana itself, the ultimate pleasure. Understanding that, I can market meditation very well. People get interested and say, yeah, I want, I want, I want. And I'm not exaggerating, that's what it's like. But a nimitta comes very strong. In the Anapanasati Sutra, it says that when the citta manifests, cittampati samvedi, that's stage number 9, experiencing the citta, that's the nimitta, the affection of the mind. The next two stages, number 10 and 11, is abhipramojjana citta and samadhana citta, which is to brighten up that nimitta, to give it power and energy and joy, and to stabilize that nimitta. So what one is doing when one is getting this beautiful light in the mind, allow it to get stronger and more blissful, but also to keep it stable. So it's not pulsating, it's not moving backwards and forwards, it's just staying there, still, brilliant, full of bliss. These are the best ways into the jhana realm, simply because you're bringing up power, and it's a well-trodden route. There are other ways into the jhanas, but if you have gained the jhanas in another way, I'd also encourage you to develop the nimitta state as well, because that makes these jhanas much more controllable, if you like. You know exactly where you are with the group. And there always comes a time when you eventually just merge into those jhanas. When you have that nimitta stage, you're on the edge of the jhana realm. But what happens next is that the mind just enters. It enters, and what is the most prominent feature of the mind is the even more intense bliss. The different jhana stages are measured by the different flavors of bliss. In the same way there's different flavors of ice cream, vanilla, chocolate, strawberry, or whatever. So there's different flavors of bliss. In every successive jhana, the bliss goes to a different level. So if you look in the first jhana, what you are focusing on naturally, without any force or decision, what occupies the mind for long periods of time is bliss. When you come out afterwards, what were you really watching? Just bliss. And you have to ask what type of bliss that was and what was happening. One of the factors of that first dharma is called vitakka vichara. And still, many people who haven't had the personal experiences would say that that is thinking. There's no way that thinking can exist in such a refined state of mind. Already thinking and naming, discussing what we know as thought has long since disappeared. You're too still for that to happen. What the Buddha meant by vitakka vichara in that context was that bliss is so strong that the mind actually holds on to that bliss. That is the vichara, the holding on. And because that is a disturbing activity of the mind, this is completely involuntary and automatic process. Because you're holding on, the bliss tends to decrease. Or you feel that the mindfulness is moving away from the bliss. That the whole jhana seems to be dissolving. Only for a second or two. Because the bliss is so strong, it brings you back into it again. Being drawn back in is called the vitakka. It's what I've called in my talks and in my book, the wobble of first jhana. But really the only way you can understand that is actually to go to the next stage, the second jhana. It's like the only time you can really understand the territory in which you live is actually to go up a hill or a mountain or a tower and look down upon it. You have to get out of that first jhana to a higher level, as it were, to look down upon it and see exactly what that is. And because of that, the first jhana is a very, very difficult one to define. When people get into deep states of meditation, and they say it's the first jhana, I often give them the benefit of the doubt. Even if it doesn't agree with other understandings of jhana. Because the first jhana is a very, very wide area, and many things qualify. But it's most important that, number one, you're not feeling the body. You don't know what the hands are doing, what the legs are doing. You can't hear sounds. And the thinking mind is gone. The mind moves, but involuntarily, in a wobble. But no thinking. Which means if you ask yourself, is it first jhana? It cannot be first jhana, or any jhana. If you can ask that question, the mind is not still enough yet. This doubt for long periods of time. Which is why that usually you have to emerge from each of these jhanas and then you look back and say, wow, what was that? And that's where you analyze what the experience was. And again, if you've only had one experience of jhanas, sometimes that there's not enough information to fully appreciate. You have to keep going back again and again and again. So you get accustomed to the territory and its landmark. And if you go back again and again and again, then you'll be able to find out exactly what it is and get to fuller knowledge of what it is. It's a very difficult thing to describe. The reason is because we're going to a place where we're not used to going. And so the descriptions which we use, the words and the language which are mostly based on the world of five senses, cannot help us here. Why people, I ask them what the experience was. They say, it's kind of like this and kind of like that. And I have to try and understand exactly what they mean. We talk in similes and metaphors. It's like this, it's like that, but it's not that. It's something completely different. But if it's been very peaceful, very stable, and afterwards it's given you huge amounts of energy and bliss, it's almost certainly the jhanas. Some people think that the jhanas are just dull states, where you just blank out. And you come out afterwards, yeah, just that first jhana. If anyone says that, yeah, just that first jhana, I realize that's not first jhana at all. They come out afterwards and, I don't
Ajahn Brahm, oh, it's so wonderful. Oh,
it's
so beautiful.
Then I say, okay, that's likely to be a Vaishnava.
The most wonderful experience of your life.
For those of you who have fallen in love, that's nothing like the jhanas. The jhanas are like falling in love times 100.
Oh, it's so wonderful. Oh.
For these are highly charged states. For these are like some of the signs. The vitaka vichara is just a movement of the mind onto its source and staying there. In a piti sukha, the wonderful thing about the happiness and joy of the first jhana is afterwards you understand what type of happiness of this that is. And it's a beautiful explanation of the Buddha when he said it's the joy and the happiness of having let go of the five senses and the body. That's what it's made of. And when you realize that, then what is that happiness? It is what happens when you completely forsake the five senses and the body. Keep reflecting on that again and again. This is the bliss when these things go. And this is what it's like when I have that body and the five senses. Gee, this body sucks, as they say in the West. It's a bunch of dukkha. It's burdensome. It's horrible. If you really realize that again and again and again and again and again and again and again, you won't be attached to this body anymore. You won't be attached to your food or seeing the cricket or sex or anything. But you know something much, 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 much better. How can you worry about that sort of stuff anymore? Those experiences just change the way, not the way you think, but the way you behave. You become far more detached to the things of the world once you know what real happiness is. As I said about that very beautiful simile about that man who'd been born blind and sold a dirty cloth. I thought, what a beautiful cloth this is. Look at my beautiful cloth. I'm just so well dressed. Look at me. Now I've got Versace dresses. I've got Gucci clothes. Look at me. And when you open your eyes, you find all these Versace Gucci clothes really stuck. They're not beautiful after all. And all the stuff which you've been striving for in this world is nothing. You've been sold a dud, sold a dirty old piece of cloth. That's what happens when you get into jhanas. Why? What have I been doing this for all my life? Worrying about what clothes, what car I have, what house I have, how much money I have, how much sex I have, you know, whether Sri Lanka wins a cricket or Australia wins a cricket. Who cares? What a waste of time. You're not saying that because of some theory. You're saying that because you've seen something much more beautiful. Which is why these jhanas are pregnant with so much insight. You see the suffering of a body. Not something you can think about, but something you see and experience. And I'll go into that more tomorrow with the insights which come from the jhanas. But beyond that first jhana is the second jhana, where because the mind can let go of that grasping of the bliss, because the vichara finishes, the vitaka finishes. Actually, what happens first of all, vitaka finishes first of all. You're holding onto that bliss so lightly that you don't move away from it anymore. It's a very fascinating something which you had to experience in stage four before you saw that in the suttas, every now and again, there was another state between the first and second jhana. Bhinna Sariputta mentioned it several times about a state with vichara but no vitaka. And this is what happens. You're holding on to that bliss, but so softly you don't move away from it. And then eventually just you don't need to hold on anymore. You've got what they call the inner confidence. You can truly let go completely, absolutely. And the second jhana is very important for people to understand. Because I always say this, in the second jhana at last you understand what this will truly is. Because that what disappears in the second jhana. Here you get a full 100% samadhi, the stillness of the mind where you can't move. The reason you can't move is because will has been completely subdued. That which causes the movement of the mind, will, Chaitanya, has been absolutely subdued. And as I've often explained, it's not just you not willing anymore, but your potential to will something has been taken away. You just can't if you wanted to. It's just no longer there for you. It's been turned off. You can't do anything. You're completely stuck. Which is why in such a state people can meditate for long periods of time. They can't come out. They can't come out because Chaitanya has been stopped. That's why people sit for long periods of time. A good description which I wanted to share about the first or second jhana. There was a novice in our monastery in Thailand many, many years ago when Ajahn Chah was still alive. And for those of you who've read any Dharma books by Ajahn Chah, I've read some of his Dharma books and I can't recognize those teachings at all. Because in reality, when Ajahn Chah would give a talk, he'd give a talk for 3 or 4 or 5 hours. And every now and again you get this beautiful pearl of wisdom, which made it worth waiting for. And when you read any books of Ajahn Chah, they edited out all the rubbish. They just kept the beautiful pearls. You're so lucky these days. I have to sit through hours and hours waiting for them. Now they've taken out all the dross and they've just got the beautiful stuff. It's just like when you dig for gold or you dig for diamonds. In a diamond mine, most of the stuff dug out is just rubbish. But then they sift it through and every now and again they find a diamond. And that's really worthwhile. That's why they have mines. That's like Ajahn Chah teaching. So much boring stuff. And every now and again you have something, wow, that was good. And that's what we remember. So I mention that because Ajahn Chah was giving one of these really boring talks late into the night. And one of these little novices was getting very, very upset. You know, even in Sri Lanka, you have these small novices, 12 or 13 years of age. Now, they're in a monastery because there's no place for them to go. And they're only little fellows, and they need to go to bed. And so this little novice was getting very upset. And he started thinking, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? And that became like a mantra in his head. When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? For maybe an hour. And then the novice had a little insight. He just turned the question around. It's not when is Ajahn Chah going to stop. He thought, when am I going to stop? And that little novice stopped. And when he opened his eyes, it was early in the morning. The talk had finished several hours previously. And he just got into his first very, very deep, beautiful meditation. And the reason I mention that story is when you go into those deep meditations, when you stop, you're absolutely still. You don't hear all the monks ringing the bell and bowing and doing the final chanting and leaving. You're just sitting there deep within yourself, unable to hear anything. You don't care because you're having the most wonderful time of your life. In deep meditation, you can't hear anything. And it's happened in some of the long retreats which I've given. People have started meditating. They cut time for lunch. They're on 8 precepts. They don't eat their lunch. They're not going to eat anything till tomorrow. And the bell goes for lunch and we get up and I see them still sitting there. I see them sitting there all through lunch and into the mid-afternoon. And I'm so happy. Someone's got a job. And we have to be very careful with them afterwards. Remember this one guy, this one Australian man, he was meditating early in the morning on a Sunday. And we used to do a couple of hours sits on the Sunday morning before the Dharma. And when we got up for Dharma, he was still sitting there. And I thought that he was getting deep by the stillness. We had our Dharma in the afternoon, about 3 or 4 o'clock, he eventually came out. I was very happy that it was one of the other disciples that listened to my talks, who knew what was going on, who was waiting for. very gently get into a quiet room. Because you're so sensitive after a long sin. Now your mind has just been in a bliss state, not of this world. If you try and come out of the world too quickly, you just can't relate to it. So you just need like a time, like a halfway room, for you to come out so you can get back to normal again. So she led him very, very gently, in this beautiful, very subtle state of mind. Just sit down for a while. Don't do anything. You can't speak to anybody because your mind is just in another space. If people didn't know that, they'd probably send him to the crazy house. But it's not a crazy house. The fellow's got a very deep meditation. When one does that, one understands the power of these jhanas. In the second jhana, it is pure samadhi, absolute stillness of mind. And the great insight which comes out of that, which we'll explore more deeply tomorrow, is that just how still the mind is when will disappears. And there you are, completely conscious, completely aware, very aware, but there's nothing going on. Like a rock, like a diamond. You sit there for hours. What you realize, this thing called Chaitanya or will, it's nothing to do with you. Awareness is still there. Chaitanya is gone. It's a fascinating thing that you're not in control of all of this. Such a relief to know you don't have to worry about what you do or what you don't do. All the process, nothing to do with you. So every time you have a choice, a will, it's not my business. Complete freedom from the will. Samadhi is very, very strong, and you can go deeper. I know that some people have been telling me that you can, when you get to the nimitta stage, you can resolve. May I get into the first jhana, or the second jhana, or the third jhana? That's possible, you can do that. It is a little bit of a shortcut. But it only works if you have an understanding of what you're resolving for. If you resolve to go to, say, Kandy, you have to know the path, the way to get there. But instead of, in 2 days' time, I'll be going to Nagoyama. I can't resolve to go there because I don't know where the heck it is. But my driver can resolve to go there. I hope he goes away. And he will get there. It's the same if you never experienced a jhana before. Or if not in a past life, because sometimes a past life memory is all you need. If you say, may I get to first jhana, and that's been a memory of a past life, then you can get there. The mind remembers and knows the route. So off it goes and takes you there. So sometimes those resolutions can work. What is very usual is because in the second jhanas and beyond, that you cannot decide within those jhanas to come out. What one usually does is make the resolution, I will enter, say, second jhana for 1 hour, or 2 hours, or 3 hours, or whatever. And it's wonderful, the more subtle your mind, the more powerful and effective are those resolutions. It works. You just come out after 2 hours or 3 hours, whatever you tell yourself to. And the mind is just so easy to work with in such subtle states. But if you go through those jhanas, in the third jhana, it's a strange thing that the samadhi is still there, the incredible stillness. You can't hear anything or feel anything. I should have mentioned in the first jhana, as the Buddha said, that sound is like a thorn to that jhana. In other words, that if the first jhana is not strong, sometimes sounds can impinge upon the experience. Obviously it has to be a very loud sound. However, once you hear that sound, technically speaking, you're not in the jhana anymore. You come out. But because only loud sounds, very sharp piercing sounds, can pierce through, very often as soon as that loud bang or whatever disappears, because of the strength of the jhana, you can go straight back in there again. In other words, if you hear the sounds, you're not in. You can't hear the sounds, then you are inside. You can go straight back in again. If you continually hear sounds, it's not really the jhana. And as the first vana gets stronger, then again you don't hear the sounds, it can't pierce it. The same with the second jhana, there's no way the sounds can come into the second jhana, or the third jhana. And the third jhana is just a different taste of happiness. There's a part of the happiness has disappeared. It's a pity part. I know that sometimes that I used to read people discussing the difference between pity and sukha. And sometimes say that pity is a mental, sukha is physical or whatever. That never made sense because as I read the suttas, sometimes the Buddha would describe it one way, sometimes another way. It's only when you experience the third jhana, when half of bliss has disappeared, the pity part, you understand what that word truly means. From experience, not through Pali. There's a different, more peaceful, more subtle state of bliss, which because of its subtlety you can stay with for even longer periods. After many experiences you know, oh, that was what the third jhana is. And when that other part of happiness, the sukha part, fades away, when the mind is incredibly still, then that becomes your fourth jhana. Again, not moving. Samadhi is still there. Absolute stillness, not able to will anything, not able to think, unable to feel the senses. That becomes the fourth jhana. And even more impressive and powerful state of peace. When you come out afterwards, that's so delightful. That is another form of happiness. The Buddha called it upeka sukha. Even though sukha is supposed to disappear, it's just a different way of looking at it. It is the bliss of pure equanimity. These are four jhanas, and they're very, very, very powerful. So I pointed out to a few people upstairs in the Gopika Moggallana Sutta, the Buddha said specifically, the only meditation which I praise and recommend and encourage are the four jhanas. The Buddha said in the Anguttara many times, without Samma Samadhi, which is always the four jhanas, the wisdom element can never be fulfilled. Sila Samadhi Panya. We need the Samma Samadhi of jhanas to develop the wisdom. So here you're learning about this incredible power and sense of the mind. And I'm very happy to see that many people on this retreat. So I've been to Sri Lanka before, but it's the first time I've taught a retreat here in Sri Lanka. To see that many of you have a good understanding of the jhanas, even experience of these things. You've obviously had some very good teachers before. Some good abilities. It's wonderful actually to reintroduce the jhanas back into Theravada Buddhism. For too long they've been looked upon as being unnecessary. They have not been encouraged. And because of that there has been a decline. And especially a decline in the people becoming heaviers. It is my understanding that these jhanas are necessary. I could be wrong there, but at the very least, they certainly help enormously. The more you get these jhanas, the more strong the mind will be, the more you will understand the teachings of the Buddha, and the more powerful your insights will be. And if in this world, in this life, you're aiming for so on and beyond, you need the power of these jhanas. They're a source of energy and insight. To gain these amazing states of release, which is why the Buddha continually encouraged them. It's the culmination of the Eightfold Path, Samma Samadhi, eighth factor, always defined as the four jhanas. And all these other factors leading up there, and from those four jhanas, there one starts to see things as they truly are. It was through the jhanas of the Buddha gained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. We all know that. It was the Buddha who said before he sat there, perhaps these jhanas are the way to Bodhi, enlightenment. And he stated, yes, they are the path to Bodhi. So they should be developed and made mashal. So you have the opportunity on this retreat. Sit there, follow the instructions, get into bliss, get a nimitta coming up, merge into the nimitta, and just go for broke. You have 1.5 days left. Who knows what will happen? Okay, so any questions about the jhana talk? Yes. Yes. Okay, the in the Anapanasati Sutra, the preliminaries before you start watching the breath, is they say that to establish sati purakata. Purakata too often has been translated in English, I'm not sure what you translated in Sinhala. It means like to put in front. And instead of using that word put in front literally, let's put your attention here. And this is only a modern thing. We think of ourselves as living in our brain somewhere. In Sri Lanka, as in Thailand, as in a whole of Asia, we always thought we were in our heart. So in front of you many years ago would have meant here somewhere. Watch your breath here, which made no sense at all. But the word purakata means to give it priority, prioritize it, put it in front metaphorically. So to prioritize mindfulness. Get mindfulness strong before you watch the breath. Otherwise, if your mindfulness isn't strong before you watch the breath, you can't follow the breath. You're not aware enough. So say, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. I wonder what my wife's doing back home. I wonder what the stock market's doing. Who's winning the cricket? What's on the TV? What's my children doing back in New York? You just, you know, the mind just wanders, because your mindfulness isn't established, first of all. So establish mindfulness, first of all. That's the exercises which I use as present moment awareness and silence, just to get mindfulness strong. And then put it on the breath, and it's easy. Just to prioritize it. Is that what you were asking? Any other questions about the jhanas? Do you remember the descriptions which I've given of the jhanas that are ones from my own experience using the words of the Buddha? For those of you who have deep meditation experiences, you may use a different language. That's why he's a skilled teacher. To be able to actually listen to what you say and to find out whether that really is a jhana or not. And sometimes even then we can make mistakes. As I say, the first jhana is so wide, and I give a lot of people the benefit of the doubt. The second jhana is quite easy to see and understand, because it's a stillness, no thought, no possibility of movement. So if you have had a deep experience, keep going further, there's always more to be done. See how still you can be. And don't be proud and think, no, I don't like Ajahn Brahm anymore because what he suggested was not what I've achieved. No, it's not fair. I thought I had first jhana, but I haven't. You may have had. It takes a while. And usually, you know, if I'm a teacher, I've got to know the students for a long while. To know how they speak, to know what they do. And only then can I be confident when they describe their experiences to me that, yeah, I have judged it right. If I've only known you for a short time, you can't very easily get it wrong. Because you don't know how you speak.
Panchavakata,
five minutes, does that
last for some time after
you go on the bed? Yes, that's very true. For example, if you've just been in the first jhana, you cannot have sex with your wife in the next couple of hours or 3 hours or whatever. It just cannot be done. You can't get angry if someone said, you've got a stupid face. You're the most ignorant, stupid, you know, Australian person I've ever seen in my whole life. You stink. Whatever it is, you just cannot get angry. Just the whole thing becomes hilarious, a joke, because you're in such a good mood. What Stalin was saying, that after the Jhana experiences, the five hindrances are so strongly suppressed. Things like sensory desire, karma chanda, vaya pada, ill will, no sloth and torpor. Very often when people get into those deep meditations, they just can't sleep sometimes for days. You go to bed, you've been up all day, and you lay back there, and your mind is so bright. There's no way you can go to sleep, because the energy of the mind is huge. But not restless, you're not thinking about many things, it's still very peaceful, but very bright. And obviously, there's no doubt, because doubt is part of the mind moving. The mind is too still to doubt. It happened that lasts for a long period of time. The deeper the jhana, not second, third, or fourth, lasts a long time. And it's the reason why that these jhanas are very effective, because the five hindrances are knocked out for long enough. If you could hear like a good Dharma discourse after you got into a jhana, why you can understand that so deeply. And that's where people become enlightened. That's where they experiences of attainment happen. You've got no hindrances, it's basically you're seeing clearly. Nothing between you and the Dhamma. So, wow, yeah.
And also, maybe Dr. Ramlal,
you come out of it. Details of more details. Yeah, that's right, yeah. This is where the food tastes amazing. If you had a jar of the first spoon of rice, wow, this is deva food. You never tasted rice, just ordinary white rice, and under any colour, which has been so delicious. Mm. So for other people, you're crazy, because your mind is so empowered. Everything looks very, very beautiful, which means you can keep your attention on things, even boring things. Instead of just thinking about the curry, looking for the body and the mind, the private cabinet, that is just a Ganata, the really powerful teachings of the Buddha. With such an empowered mind. I call that empowered mind like the match. And the Dhamma is the gunpowder. When the match and the gunpowder come together, bang! Defilements get destroyed. Without the match, you have all the gunpowder you like, all the teachings of the Buddha. Hear it from the Buddha himself and all the great arahants. You know it all. You can recite the Pali Tripitaka backwards. You know all the teachings. And that's just having a big store of gunpowder. Without the match, nothing happens. Or you can have a match, but no gunpowder. You've got the jhanas, but you haven't heard the Buddha's teachings. Still nothing happens. With the match and the gunpowder. Nati jhanaga panyasa, panyam nati jayato. There's no wisdom without, no jhana without wisdom, no wisdom without jhana. Yam hi jhana and cha panya jhana. Then the one who has jhana and wisdom. So way, nirvana, santake. They are knocking on the door of Nibbana. Right next to it. That first we said to Dharma. So you get the jhanas, that's a match. Into that, you know, heaps and heaps of Dharma. You've got storerooms of gunpowder. But what you need to do is light the match. It's easy to go bang. And there you go, you've disappeared. Any other comments, questions?
Yeah.
Ah, very good question. Very good question. Because it's very common, the first time one gets into deep meditation, it's so beautiful, it's so wonderful, the best thing you've ever experienced in your life. It's so common, if you haven't got a good teacher, it'll take a long time to get it back again. And you get so frustrated. Oh, why can't I get this back again? Why can't I get this back again? And the reason is because it's the wanting to get it back. I'm very grateful for you asking that question because I never mentioned the danger of jhana. And the danger of an experience of jhana is it does arouse the wrong type of craving. Craving to get back there. Craving for the result. And the solution to that problem is always stop trying to get the jhanas. Instead, try to get the stillness. Put the causes into place. Focus on the causes, not the result. People who think about when the university, oh, when am I going to get my degree? When am I going to get my degree? I want my degree. Come on, I need my degree. I want my degree. Come on. You've got to focus on the courses. You've got to go and do the assignments, go to the lectures, go to the tutorials, put forth the effort of what causes a degree to happen. Just wishing for it never gets you anywhere. It's exactly the same with the jhanas. Instead of, when am I getting, I want to get to jhanas, come on, I want jhanas. That wanting disturbs the mind. You've got to develop stillness. Oh, another good word is contentment. Just be so content. If the jhana comes, it can come. If it doesn't come, I'm fine. Okay, I'm going to mention the simile which Darwin asked about last night, the simile of the donkey and the carrot. I was going to maybe mention this tomorrow, but it's a good time now. Donkey and carrot. In southern Europe, many years ago, they used to use for transport donkeys and carts, like in Sri Lanka, you have the bullock cart. Remember the old bullock carts? But bullocks are much easier to deal with than donkeys, because a bullock, you can actually whack it and it will move. Donkeys are so stubborn, no matter how many times you hit them, they will not move. They just do not respond to pain. But what makes a donkey move, in southern Europe, they tie a stick to the back of its head. The end of the stick will be about 2 feet in front of the donkey. On the end of the stick will be a string, and on the end of the string, a carrot. So a donkey would see a nice carrot in front of it, about a foot or 2 foot in front of its mouth. And so it moved towards the carrot. Because it moved towards the carrot, and the carrot was on the string attached to a stick on the end of its back, the carrot would also move. So the donkey would be going towards the carrot, and the carrot would always be 2 feet in front of the donkey. And that's how they got the donkey to pull the carts. And that's the only way it would work. And the donkey would be walking, walking, walking. Donkeys are very stupid. And so it would never get the carrot, but it would pull the cart all the way, because the hope was there it would get the carrot. That's very much like life. You know, you think you can get happiness in life. You know, getting happiness in your marriage, or getting enough money to live by, or enough success, or you know, to get the best score in cricket. So you almost get the 190, but 200 was just 10 runs away, whatever it was. The carrot is always a little bit too much in front. And for a lot of life, we are chasing the carrots of happiness. We never quite get there, any close, but never quite. About 30, 40 years ago, Buddhism came to southern Europe. And I think that's why the donkeys learned how to catch the carrots. So they can't use donkeys and carrot carts anymore. They have to use, like, vehicles, like petrol engines. Because the donkey learned how to catch the carrot. And this is how a donkey catches a carrot. The owner puts a stick on the back of its neck, 2 feet in front of its head, the string with the carrot on the end. And the donkey sees that carrot. And it runs as fast as it can after that carrot. Really fast. Now of course, it doesn't matter how fast the donkey runs, the carrot also goes exactly the same speed. So it's still 2 feet in front. But the Buddhist donkey, the Buddhist donkey knows how to stop. So the donkey puts on the brakes and comes to a complete halt. And as the donkey stops, it sees the carrot go further away than it's ever been before. It swings 4 feet away. But donkey has faith. Faith in its teacher. Just stop, leave it alone, let go. Don't do anything. Just wait. Kanti paramam kapokitika. Patient endurance is the ultimate practice. So donkey is just patient. Sees the carrot go further away than it's ever been before. And then a strange thing happens. The carrot starts coming towards the donkey. This never happened before. And soon it's 2 feet in front of the donkey's mouth again, like it normally is. But this time, it's coming at great velocity, right towards the donkey. And all the donkey needs to do is wait a little bit longer, and just say, the door of my mouth is open to you, carrot. And it comes in. The donkey doesn't need to do anything. Just needs to be still and let go. And then the carrot comes to the donkey. That's a beautiful simile about meditation, Makapala, how enlightenment happens. You've already been running after enlightenment long enough. Or running after jhana. Now stop. Don't go chasing after anything. No craving, no wanting, then go. When you stop, when you first stop in meditation, sometimes your mind goes crazy than it's been before. You're not trying to hold the breath, sometimes you can't hold anything. It doesn't matter, the cat's going further away. Just hold still. Don't move. Sometimes you're crazier than you've ever been before. The cat is further away. No way can I get jhana and lightness so far away. Stay still. And then you find the carrot's coming towards you. You're sitting there doing not very much. And the breath comes in. Thank you very much. And the breath gets very still. That's nice. You don't do anything. The beautiful breath comes and imitator comes up. Oh, that's really neat. I never asked for that. And you go into the jhanas all by yourself. It comes towards you. And then enlightenment comes right into you. You don't do a thing. You disappear. The last 3 months retreat of my monastery, I focused on a wonderful saying in the Visuddhimagga. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Enlightenment is, but not the one who enters. I focused on the first part of that. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. It's a teaching of anatta. More than that, if you're travelling on this path, if you are trying to get jhana, then you're a traveller. You're trying to get somewhere. If you're trying for Magapala, you're a traveller. And the more there's a traveller there, the more the path disappears. But when you disappear, when the traveller, the one trying to achieve things or get somewhere, disappears, then the path is. It manifests, it gets very clear. The more you disappear, the smoother and wider is the path. When you're there, sometimes it's walking in the dark. The more you disappear, the more it's like a road, like outside this house. When you fully disappear, it's like going on a multi-lane highway. The more you disappear, the more the path appears. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. There's a traveller there. Ah.